People have poked some fun at the writing style of Ernest Hemingway over the years. You know, the short sentences, punchy approach, getting to the point. But that Hemingway style is one of the things that made him so well-loved in his career, and clearly long after. Hemingway wrote A Farewell to Arms and The Sun Also Rises and other major works. Now, he is the focus of another book, one which concentrates on the collection of things the author left behind. Michael Katakis is the editor of Ernest Hemingway, Artifacts from a Life. Michael is the author, co-author, or editor of several other works. His solo books include A Thousand Shards of Glass, There Is Another America, and Traveler, Observations from an American in Exile. Michael Katakis, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Well, hello, Jeffrey, and how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. I guess the first thing I'm curious about, aside from the collection, is where it is. Why is there a Hemingway collection at the JFK Library?
Well, the reason the collection of Hemingway materials is at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston is because Mrs. Kennedy, Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy, had asked for them to be there, and Hemingway's widow, Mary, was happy to oblige.
So you've had quite a few discussions, and we'll get into the nature of the relationship with Pat Hemingway, one of Ernest's children, who laments that many important artifacts did not get there. Are they elsewhere or just lost to history?
Well, the majority are lost, but what we have at the John F. Kennedy Library, for instance, are over 11,000 photographs that I had to go through. Thousands of letters, but letters are dispersed. There's letters also at Princeton University. And he also had a whole mass of other things that he kept. You see, he didn't keep a journal. He kept all of these materials as an aid to memory. But he also kept these things because tactily they were really wonderful, and they show, for instance, tickets. Receipts from Brentano's in Paris of handwritten books that the person puts down and the prices. They're beautiful artifacts, and it shows you how much has been lost with the kind of severe digital practicality that exists today. These things were actually of daily commerce, were beautiful. And he obviously felt an attachment to them more than just for memory. He had pretty good taste, it seems.
I'm most surprised, I guess, by that revelation that Ernest Hemingway didn't keep a journal. It seems like he wrote constantly, but he wrote more or less for publication constantly.
Yes, he was making lists. But what he was doing was, one of the criticisms he received early in his career, which was when his friends went to Spain, and this altercation happened between friends, which becomes The Sun Also Rises. Some of his friends, Donald Ogden Stewart in particular, were confused because they said, wait a minute, this is straight out reporting. And some of that is true. He took the events, almost some of them verbatim, but then it moves through his imagination, and it becomes a little something else. But this was a criticism initially. I could point to this in many of his books, in many of his writings. They come from personal experience. Some of them are very autobiographical, the Nick Adams stories. He's pulling out life that he is seeing and experiencing, and then he's turning it into literature.
You know, I wanted to take a little departure from Ernest himself and talk about your personal exposure to him, because your knowledge of him growing up is similar to mine. Our ages appear similar. Ernest Hemingway was gone before you even knew about him.
Absolutely,
like.
Yes.
So
yes.
When you read his books as a young man, what did they kindle in you, Michael?
Well, you know, the irony is that the first time I heard the name Ernest Hemingway was in Oak Park, Illinois, as a boy. My mother had died the same day John Kennedy was assassinated. And we had a family, some relatives who lived in Oak Park, and we were stunned. We were in shock. My mother had been ill for a long time. My father was an immigrant to the United States. And in Oak Park, an uncle, trying to get our minds off of things, said to me as a little boy, you know, just a few blocks away, a very famous American writer was was raised, Ernest Hemingway. Now, this left me for a while, but then my father used to read to me. And one of the things he read to me was The Old Man and the Sea. And it captured, as it did for millions of others, a kind of imagination for me and a hunger for the world. And so I did what a lot of young people did. I have gone out and had my Hemingway moment as a young man, running with the bulls in Spain, just moving around the world, Cuba, what have you. And I realized that I despised the legend. He had been where he had always been, in the books. And the legend, or the myth, which he had a part in creating, obscured the extraordinary life and the complicated life he actually had.
And as you put it in the book succinctly, his greatness lay in the work and not in his lifestyle. So was it the running of the bulls that convinced you of that?
Yes, the running of the bulls. I think at one point, I'm not sure, I turned on the sixth day I was running or the fifth day, and I said, "What the hell are you doing, Katakis?" and I said, "Your last name is Katakis, not Hemingway." And I think I became a little bit more wise.
The book is...
Which I should thank Mr. Hemingway.
Yes, yes. Learning by example, but sometimes by hard example. The book is called Ernest Hemingway, Artifacts from a Life. Much more to talk about with Michael Katakis when we return from a break. On the way to the break, I will politely remind you that we are in the second to last day of our fund drive here on JPR with about $100,000 left to raise. So a lot of pledges, big and small, required over the course of the next day and a half to pull off this drive successfully. We beseech you to give us a call at 888-552-6191 or to pledge online at ijpr.org. Thank you so much. The Jefferson Exchange will return in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Michael Katakis, who is an author, an editor, and a world traveler. And he's put together a book about Ernest Hemingway based on his work as the person in charge of Hemingway's literary estate. Michael Katakis has edited Ernest Hemingway Artifacts from a Life, and it really is tactile things, receipts from bookstores, train and steamship tickets, and things like that, that Hemingway left behind that really helped shape an idea of what this human being was like, not just the person who appears in so many movies about Hemingway. Join us on The Exchange with your own thoughts and reflections on Hemingway's writing and his lifestyle, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Michael, you mentioned the fact that you'd already figured out that Hemingway's greatness lay in the work and not in his lifestyle, direct quote there. But then what was the project that led you to contact Patrick Hemingway, Ernest's son?
Well, Patrick and I have been working together now for nearly 20 years. And originally, I had contacted him about a collection of essays that were being done for a book called Sacred Trust: Essays on Stewardship and Responsibility. And I had read something that Patrick had written about his many years in Africa, and I thought that he would be a terrific contributor. So I wrote a letter to him and received a lovely letter in reply, and we agreed. And then shortly after, he had promised to write an essay, which he did, which was called The Elephants of Tsavo, which was beautiful and tragic and was very prescient about population growth and what is happening in the world today. And as a result of handling all of this, he said, "You know, I really like the way you've done this. Do you fish? Do you fly fish?" And I said, "Yes, I've been fly fishing since I was a kid." And he said, "Would you like to come to Montana?" And when we got to Montana fishing discussing matters, he said, "We'd been looking for someone to take over my father's estate to help manage it." And I said, "Well, you should do that with a family member." And he said, "My family's crazy." And I said, "Everybody's family's crazy." And what happened as a result of that, I declined twice. And Patrick served a lot of beautiful wild game and liquor that night. And the next morning, my wife told me you had promised Patrick to help him. And I said, that can't be true. And she said, do you not remember? I said, I do not. And I was reluctant to call a man a liar, especially seeing they had the witness of my wife. So that's how we began.
Wow. So you mentioned you'd already figured out that the greatness was in the words, not in the running with the bulls and the other things that Hemingway is famous for. But then I'm sure there's another perspective that comes from managing the literary estate. I mean, so over those two decades, how different has Hemingway, the real private person, become from the public figure and the literary giant?
Well, he's far more nuanced. With all these discussions with his son, I knew all three sons, and their stories match in some ways, don't match in other ways, but he was, like so many people, a man who was complicated and a man who also had this extraordinary talent or vision that he had to work very hard for. This idea that he was a genius somehow dismisses the hard work that was involved in how he struggled with words. But I must tell you, the surprise has been to me of the kinds of people that are obsessed with Hemingway who call me on a regular basis during these last 20 years. One man in particular who called me about starting a company called Great Tales, T-A-I-L-S, with this extraordinary idea of putting the world's great literature on toilet paper, and wanted to start with Hemingway so people could read as they were going on to their duties in the restroom. I listened to him politely, thanked him for his time and his consideration, and directed him to the Faulkner estate, hoping that perhaps they had a different view.
And I'm guessing your feelings about Faulkner's writing are not as warm as your feelings about Hemingway's writing.
Actually, Faulkner wrote one of my favorite short stories, A Rose for Emily, and so I think I was terribly unfair to Mr. Faulkner. But it seemed like the right thing at the time. I should have said Steinbeck.
That was a good off-the-cuff maneuver,
yes,
though.
Yes.
So Hemingway, you write, was taking life in.
Yeah.
Unlike in this current age where people are recording everything and seeing nothing, which is a bit of an indictment for our time. But so how did he do it? What could we learn from how Ernest Hemingway took life in?
Well, I'll tell you how, in great contradiction to how we're living today. First of all, he lived in an analog world, not a digital world. And in my view, the digital world is causing people to become more like digital slaves than individuals that are really paying attention. He was listening to the way people spoke. He was watching how people did their jobs, how they thread a line, how they would cook a meal. He was constantly thinking about the taste when he drank that cold wine with oysters. That's why I've never seen him as an American writer. I've seen him as a writer writing of those things that people of any culture and time can relate to: love and loss, war, the taste of a wonderful meal, spending time with a lovely partner in bed, as he would say. These are things of life, not of nationalism or of a certain country. And his appeal was wide because his hunger was wide. He wanted to take a big bite out of life and quickly, because he felt he had a lot of things to write about and to do. And it is very different, I think, from the way things are being done today. And I'll leave it to others to determine if that's good or bad. I will say, it's been interesting listening to some people who say to me, and this has actually happened, where they said, can you imagine how much faster and how much more he could have written with a computer? That's an extraordinary statement.
It is.
That says, at least to me, how someone is not connected with what it takes to do that work that he was doing. It wasn't about speed. It was about paying attention.
Well, like many great writers, he was a good observer of humans and the things they do. So
yes, and he got in trouble with his parents, who really didn't like the book he sent them. In the initial part of his career, they considered it dirty language. And in the book, he writes a letter to them declaring his artist independence and saying, I am trying to get to the way people are, not the way you would wish them to be. Some things will be good and some things will be bad, but I'm trying to write so when you read it, it seems truer than true. And this is the coming of an artist, not pandering, not playing to the public, but following their own voice. And then Gertrude Stein criticized him a great deal for the same reason, saying he was writing dirty stories. And that concerned up in Michigan.
Wow. So a lot more we're learning here about Ernest Hemingway today. The book is called Ernest Hemingway, Artifacts from a Life. It's a collection of letters and you know, things as small as bookstore receipts, but they loom large when you put them all together, as Michael Katakis has as the editor and introducer of the collection. He manages Hemingway's literary estate and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You may join the conversation to share your thoughts about Ernest Hemingway's life and work and how it's influenced you over the years. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. His letters, Hemingway's letters, Michael, boy, the pain expressed in losing Agnes von Karowski, but it's expressed still so eloquently. It's not yeah, done in rage. I mean, do his letters come off very much like his fiction?
His letters, I adore his letters because they pop, and they're like literature itself, except it's personal. And from the time he's a boy, the way he's writing things is almost direct and hilarious, where he writes a letter, I think it's to his father or to his mother, of the teacher who slaps a boy with a rawhide strap after he's knocked another boy's teeth out. And it's very matter of fact, and he's a little boy. And his letters are brutal, lovely, supportive, kind, loving. They run the gamut of who he was, depending on who he's speaking to. The exchanges between Patrick, for instance, and he, when Patrick was in Africa, are beautiful, are absolutely lovely as far as I'm concerned. And Patrick said, my father provided me with a magical childhood. Even with all the difficulties, there is another side to this person. And if you like, I'll tell you a very funny story at some point if we have time.
We will, I think. But I want to talk a little further about the letters, because it's a good device of yours, Michael, to put them in here with little introduction. So, for example, the December 1923 rant to Ezra Pound comes through in its full glory before you even realize what's hit you, and more than half the words we can't air on the radio. Was this a fairly typical Hemingway disgorgement of his inner soul?
Well, he could do that. I mean, most of his letters that I've come across weren't that elaborately colorful. but I have to say, I when you read that letter, did you get a sense that maybe he was chortling while he was writing it?
I think eventually, yes. I think it started out angry, and after a while, it's like, well, I've been using this word indicating bowel movements already, so I'm going to keep using it for a while.
Yes, and he just keeps going, which I think probably Ezra Pound was howling when he got that. But there was something Patrick told me that was in the Hemingway family that I really love. It was called rough joking. And, for instance, when someone alluded to recently in a book that Hemingway may have slept with Josephine Baker,
the famous
Patrick
dancer
leaned over to me in Montana and said, now listen, pal, do you really think my father slept with Josephine Baker? And I said, no, Pat, I don't. He said, you're on the right road, young man. Something to that effect. So there was this rough joking that went on that I think was very hilarious. For instance, Hemingway called his Polish translator at the time, who he so thought was such a wonderful man, the magnetic pole. So, you know, he came up with these, unlike our president, his nicknames for people were more kind.
So there is something else, though, here, and you've alluded to this a bit already about, and we've talked about the powers of observation, and so right as that we begin to look at the letters, even from early in life, and you move very quickly into his adulthood, but it seems like the manly man image that and I don't know if Hemingway projected this or it was projected upon him, obscured what was really a very observant and ultimately a fairly sensitive guy.
Yes, I think you've caught it absolutely right. I think Hemingway was guilty of creating his own persona, and then the media and others took it, and he made the mistake that all people make in positions of fame. They construct this narrative, and then they think they ultimately can always control it. And that was not the case for him or for anyone else in those positions. He was a sensitive man. He, as the letter at the end that John Steinbeck wrote about him when he heard about his death, he said politely and respectfully that he was also a very vain man. I think some argument could be made about that. The relationship between he and his mother was very difficult at times, but you read the letters, and they're rather loving with each other. So I think the question is, who is Hemingway? Is he this, or is he that? And the answer is yes.
Yes,
he's
all
both. Mm-hmm. He's all.
So we mentioned a bit of his upbringing, Oak Park, Illinois. Really was a creature of the 20th century, born in July 1899. So what were the family circumstances that allowed him to get into writing, and how soon did he begin writing in his life?
Well, he's living a pretty good life in Oak Park. You know, his father's a doctor. His mother is a music teacher, gives lessons. They're living a bit of a privileged life. They can afford a cabin at Walloon Lake in Michigan. They have a nice life. And Hemingway is scribbling from the very beginning. He is writing letters to baseball card companies, making clear what he wants, and he writes them very, very interestingly and beyond his years, quite frankly. And even in the beginning, as a very young boy, he is writing in a very descriptive way, which the only thing I could come up with was he is looking at things and he's already in a reporter's stance. This is what I'm seeing. I write it down without evaluation or further elucidation. This is what I see. This is what or I killed the porcupine, I had to whack it three times, or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So he is writing in a reporter's style from the beginning, and it's charming, actually, in a little boy.
So he got into the Kansas City Star at the tender age of 18. How did that gig come about?
That was helped through connections, family connections, and people who knew people, and he got a shot. And at the Kansas City Star, the Kansas City Star style book starts to really inform him. And he's already, from what I could see in his early writings, he's on this road. What helps is the Kansas City Star style book helps refine that road that he's on and helps him with his journalism. But clearly he's also thinking, why can't these be used for writing or short stories or anything else, which was his goal. He's moving toward what they would call at the time legitimate writing, and that's where he's going. And he uses, as he did so many things, this as part of that. And with it, he starts to create the new 20th century literature.
It's a short, punchy, basically one thought to its sentence writing style that kind of presages what came in broadcasting not very long after that.
Right. His impact on this kind of style cannot be ill considered when you look at how the 20th century, the early 20th century, moves. It's as if everyone starts talking like him. Humphrey Bogart, all of they're all talking like he's writing. And even people would show up in Paris and in New York becoming characters, Jake and Lady Duff, and pretending and speaking in those ways. So that's why he was almost dismissed as a trendsetter initially, which suggested something, you know, momentarily in fashion, but that certainly wasn't the case.
He is lasting much longer than a trend, is Ernest Hemingway. The book we're talking about is Ernest Hemingway, Artifacts from a Life. Michael Katakis manages the Hemingway Literary Estate and is the editor and introducer of the book. We'll come back and talk more with Michael. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you. Don't forget, it's the second to final day of Fund Drive. 888-552-6191 for your pledge of support, or pledge online at ijpr.org. Thanks. The exchange is back in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about Ernest Hemingway with someone who's come to know Ernest Hemingway well, but sort of once removed. Michael Katakis manages the Hemingway Literary Estate and has in his access a collection of artifacts from the Hemingway collection at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, and has assembled a book that looks at these artifacts, things like photographs and maps and train tickets and store receipts and things that give you an idea of what Hemingway had around him in his life and helps you form a picture of the man. His letters help a lot, too, I should point out. The book is called Ernest Hemingway, Artifacts from a Life. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. We've been talking about Hemingway. Let us hear from Ernest Hemingway.
No writer who knows the great writers who did not receive the prize can accept it other than with humility. There is no need to list these writers. Everyone here may make his own list according to his knowledge and his conscience.
Ernest Hemingway, the intro to his Nobel Prize speech in 1954, acknowledging that there were other writers at least as good as he was. 7 years later, Ernest Hemingway dead of suicide in Idaho. So we didn't get as much of Ernest Hemingway as we certainly could have. But we're learning a lot about him here. And I just wonder how delicious it is for you, Michael, to follow this paper trail, to track Ernest Hemingway's progress through life.
Well, you know, I have my own work, but I didn't really want to do this book. Patrick asked because they wanted somehow to pull all of this together. I said, all right, I'd take it on, but I had no idea. I had no idea that four and a half years later, that's how long it would take to pull all of this together and to review it. I have gotten a sense of the man. I've been very fortunate that I've had all these years in talking with Patrick about intimate details about his father that give me a lovely picture. Not always a good picture, but a picture that I can kind of trust. And then diving into all of this material gives me this other picture, but they're not really opposite. They are what I expected all along, a complicated man in a complicated life at a complicated time in the 20th century. And so it all makes a bit of sense to me now, because the book here is more of a scrapbook of the 20th century that Hemingway lived through, and how that century affected him, his art, and his life.
Well, truly a creature of the 20th century at a time when, as you mentioned, things were getting difficult. He became an adult, as the United States was entering World War One. He's at the Kansas City Star at age 18. That didn't last long. So what made him decide to go into World War One, and what role did he play?
Well, I think he was a young man looking for adventure. And I think he was a young man who was really searching for life, life's stories. What better place to find those stories than in war? And as an ambulance driver, he sees some extraordinary things that, in my view, change him. And when he is wounded, let's be honest, this is extraordinary stuff. He gets wounded. He starts getting medals from everyone. He has movie star good looks. Women like to be around him. His pals like to hang around him. This is very heady stuff for a young man who comes back to the United States wearing a cape. And his parents expected him to be just old Ernie again. And already he was too big. His dreams were too big for the quiet Sundays of Oak Park.
And yet he moves on to the Toronto Star. And so, I mean, it's a big paper in a big town, but
it is, but his letter about how much he hates Canada and Canadians is quite something.
What was the line? This is an awful city or terrible city?
Yeah, and he just says, you know, the most god-awful place. Now, I've been to Canada. I think he overstated it. I think it's pretty nice.
I do, too.
But I think what he was complaining about, I'm going to suggest, was not enough adventure. Not enough adventure. And I think that's what he felt like in the United States as well. He lived the majority of his life not here.
So he worked his way into the literary crowd in Paris fairly young. How did he get entree to that?
Sherwood Anderson gave him letters. Originally, they being Hadley and he, were going to go to Italy. And Sherwood Anderson said, no, everything's happening in Paris and it's cheaper. And so they make an adjustment in their plans, and he has letters of introduction to Gertrude Stein, I believe to Ezra Pound. A connection is made with F. Scott Fitzgerald, and we're off to the races.
So there's a great artifact. I mean, there are many good ones in here, obviously, but Hemingway's first book, 3 Stories and 10 Poems.
Oh, yeah.
And who did he send this to that helped propel him to greater fame?
Oh, he sent it to everyone he could, who he thought he could get a review from. And already, I believe it's that first one that got some mention in the New York Times, if I remember correctly. I don't have the book in front of me. But people, even before that came out, when he had been doing some of his short stories, and realized that the talk in Paris, there was a buzz going on. Who was going to be the lead writer for their generation after the war? And the buzz started moving around Paris that this kid may be that person. People had not seen stories like this before or written like this before. And so this buzz started, and it was a quite exciting time for him.
It really was, and again, we talked about his letters and just how fun it is to read the letters. It doesn't feel too weird reading somebody else's mail, but there it is. And I have to wonder, though, we talked about the letter that he sent to Ezra Pound in December 1923, in its full glory of profanity, but I had to wonder at that time, though, I mean, did Ernest Hemingway make many enemies? Did he send letters this angry to people who were not his friends?
Yes. Not a lot, but some, when he thought he was being cheated out of money that was owed him by some news agencies, or he could be very direct. I wouldn't call it rude. I didn't find that, because remember the letter with the obscenities about this other person was written to his friend Ezra Pound. So it was a different kind of approach. He could probably be free with his friend. He would have never really written a letter like that directly to the person.
It would have changed the words, I'm sure.
Oh,
but
yes.
I wonder if the intensity would have been there.
Oh, yes, because, you know, he was still he was still the middle class kid from Oak Park. I mean, there were some lines he didn't cross. He could be, when it was really called upon, to be really a deferential gentleman. So I can't perceive of him writing a letter like that directly to, let's say, Gertrude Stein. But to his friend, yes. I think that Hemingway could be very, very direct. The letter that he wrote, that we are unsure if it was sent, I think it was probably not sent, the scholars say it was not, to Senator Joseph McCarthy, was a typical kind of letter where he is telling the senator in a very polite way how sick he is of his big mouth and invites him to come to Cuba so his son can beat him up, his smallest son. You know, and we must not forget the person who was sitting, I'm sure he was addressing this not only to Mr. Senator McCarthy, but to Roy Cohn, who we've heard more about as of late.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think that he could be very funny in the way he couched his anger, but you understood that he was angry, but without having to use expletives all the time or losing control. He seemed to be much more targeted than that. And with his friends, oh my gosh, you know, with Gary Cooper and Marlena Dietrich, the letters are absolutely great fun and wonderful.
So, Michael, we have to go soon. I want to ask a final question. If there is one artifact in this collection above all others that you most treasure as a great example of the life of Ernest Hemingway?
That I love? Well, that's a hard one to do, but I'll tell you one that I really love, and it is the billet ticket. To show you how beautiful tickets used to be, a billet ticket that opens up almost like a leather case, and in it is the official billet, where they're supposed to go on the train or the ship, and both of their photographs, Ernest Hemingway and his wife at the time, Pauline Hemingway. And there's something really beautiful about that, and even after they were no longer together, even after there was some recriminations, he kept that. And that tells me a lot about him, too.
It's a gorgeous collection and a very handsome book as well. We get to understand Ernest Hemingway a whole lot better through this collection. It is called Ernest Hemingway, Artifacts from a Life. It has been edited and introduced by Michael Katakis, who is the manager of Hemingway's literary estate. And that came through a relationship with Patrick Hemingway, the author's son.
And drinking, right.
It became about, right. That's a great story. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
All right, been a pleasure.